What a better way to reconcile than we say, not only do we value these lands and we believe in the power of them, we believe in the power of these lands so much that we believe that they could be an instrumental part in real reconciliation, which our country is so desperate for. Like, they could hold such a special place, not just the history of violence and genocide and death, but could hold this place in the history of reconciliation.
This is Sarah.
And Beth.
You're listening to Pantsuit Politics,
the home of grace-filled political conversations.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a very special episode of Pantsuit Politics. I am here with my beloved husband, Nicholas Holland. Welcome to Pantsuit Politics.
Well, thank you for having me on Pantsuit Politics. It's a joy and honor. It's beautiful studio we're in today.
Yeah, we're in the Annex studio at the Holland household, aka my closet on the floor.
In beautiful uptown Paducah, Kentucky.
Before we get into the show, I have a couple ideas. I just want to workshop with you real quick. Remember, I am a professional. I thought what we could do is talk about like really specific things you love about me. Thoughts?
Yeah, it's great. It's a great topic.
Okay. I thought we could work through like our like inside meme jokes, just like run through them where nobody really knows what we're talking about.
Yeah, that sounds good. We should just sprinkle those throughout.
So people are really confused.
Constantly confused.
Okay, good. I'm glad you agree with that. So that's our agenda today, everybody. We're going to work through why I'm amazing and our favorite memes.
Just in jokes.
In jokes.
From nearly 20 years of marriage. It ought to be real thrill for you guys.
It's going to be so good. Okay, before we get started, this is important because Nicholas is our Patreon officer. He's the one who, you really pushed us to do Patreon to begin with, right? I mean, you pushed me to do the podcast and Patreon. You're the engine behind everything.
I don't know about that, but I'm the idea man. I like to have lots of ideas that I present to you and that you mostly shoot down. I have a few occasionally really good ones. Like, maybe we should start a podcast.
Yeah.
And I don't say we. Maybe you should start a podcast. And then you seem to be working really hard at this. Maybe people would be willing to pay you a little money for a little extra content.
It changed our life. I can't tell you enough how much the support on Patreon means to all of us. You know, and the big change recently was we moved my Instagram news brief to Patreon. And honestly, I think the biggest exciting change for me with Patreon, especially recently, is, you know, I always thought, well, it'll be this place and we can give people more. But it has turned into the best community. Like, it gives us so much. It is really where we have the best conversations. It's where, like, I watch you guys have the most amazing conversations. I feel like I learn something in the comment thread of the news brief every day. Someone is like, well, here's my experience in this part of the country, and let me add this layer of interesting sort of evidence to that side of the story. It's the best place on the internet. That's my case for joining Patreon. So today we're going to tackle a couple headlines, and then we're going to talk about one of your favorite topics.
The national parks.
And then we're going to talk about what's on our mind outside politics.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you. A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
So that I do not like to spend my time or money in salons when I can help it. But I do enjoy a good manicure, and I especially enjoy spending time with my daughters. doing the Olive and June Manny system at home, because we can all get a good-looking manicure for around $2. We know that the polish won't chip and will last at least a full week. We get to await with anticipation the new colors that come out each season. The girls love being able to add some sparkles or choose whether they want their top coat to be matte or shiny. We just have a really good time together with salon-grade tools that are so easily explained so that we can do a really good job taking care of our nails, but do it all from the comfort at home. All the choices of a big salon stored in a basket in my closet for when we're ready to hang out together. The Olive and June Manny system is a real game changer. So visit oliveandjune.com/pantsuit for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/pantsuit for 20% off your first Manny system.
Okay, moving on to the news. It's, you know, it's really, really difficult. The situation in Minnesota has gotten more intense and more heartbreaking. It was already so difficult with the trial of Derek Chauvin, especially, you know, right now they're starting with a defense, which is just, it's difficult to listen to. It's difficult to listen. Everybody deserves their defense, but it's not exactly easy to listen to them try to argue that that's not why George Floyd died. That the actions of Derek Chauvin were not the reason that he died. Like, that's just not easy to hear. And then on top of all of that, we have the death of 20-year-old Dante Wright. He was shot and killed by Kim Potter, an now ex-Brooklyn Center police officer, who, as of today, as we're recording on Thursday, has been charged with secondary manslaughter. You and I got in a pretty intense conversation about this last night.
We did.
We get in a lot of intense conversations about this. About the news.
Yeah. Well, it's just very hard to talk about this at all because it just seems so commonplace and so unnecessary. And the conversations devolve into sort of the details of each case.
Yeah.
Which is so, I guess it's important in one respect, but at the same time, it completely ignores that this was an entirely unnecessary death.
Yeah.
That he was stopped for something that is silly, that people are not typically stopped for, that he was, it at least appears from a lot of the details that he was profiled more or less, and that the stop itself, he had a warrant for his arrest out. There's no question about that, but there's a real question from in my eyes as to whether any of this was necessary and the way that it went down, obviously tragic in his death. But, you know, a lot of this conversation now has turned to, well, was it an accident? Did she mean to shoot him? You know, was it a taser mix up? And I think that's a conversation that's worth having about whether or not tasers and firearms should be so similar in their design. But it's not the one I want to have right now about this.
Well, and that's kind of what you and I got into last night, because, you know, I think this whole taser mix up thing, I mean, it's a conversation. People have claimed it's happened before, but even if you believe every person who says I mixed up the taser and the gun, it's still not a huge number of cases. To me, whether or not you believe she was, you know, meant to pull her gun or meant to pull the taser, you know, our argument was whether or not it was accidental. And to me, it's like it's 12 seconds of time. That's an incredibly short period, which makes it all the more heartbreaking that, you know, you can pack so many individual actions into 12 seconds. But I think your point is the right one, which is it doesn't matter. Like, it's not about what happened after he got pulled over. It's like, why was he pulled over to begin with? And why do we have, you know, you and I were talking last night that both of us have been driving around for literal years with broken taillights and have never gotten pulled over ever for either of our broken taillights.
Yes, which I think both the mysteries of those taillights is that our children broke our taillights, just so you know.
Yeah, that's so true. And so, but I mean, that's just the thing. It's like when I was in law school and it was in law school till I learned, like, I thought everybody just got pulled over for speeding. And, you know, all the people in my class were like, no, white girl, that's not why people get pulled over for by the police officer. They get pulled over for all manner of reasons. And really, there's one reason, because a lot of times they're being profiled. And I just think, like, I think the argument is, even if you give police officers every benefit of the doubt, which I don't, you know, whatever. I think, like, why is it escalating? Why is a traffic stop escalating? Why are we pulling people over for what in the training thought I need to escalate to violence, even if he was trying to get back into his car? It's not like they were pursuing some sort of mass shooter or somebody who had, like, just committed a crime. Even with the warrant, it's not like it was for some recent violent action. You know, that's, to me, it's like the whole process, the flow of actions that come from, you can even argue they come from training. That's problematic. Like, something is broken. And I'm not really, it is hard not to believe the people who say it can't be reformed. Like, we have to start over.
Yeah, well, definitely. And there is some reform effort going on, or at least proposed in Minnesota today. I think there's a bill being considered, or one of the, there's a legislator there who's insisting that they stop their budget negotiations to pass public safety laws, including one that would prohibit traffic stops for these minor offenses, like things hanging in your windows or a broken taillight or even, you know, expired tags. These are not stops that should be happening, because what they lead to.
And I know that you hate Malcolm Gladwell, which
I don't like Malcolm
Gladwell. You don't like Malcolm. This is a source of discord in our marriage. But he did such a good, I don't know, I think it might be in the book that you just have a fury about, but about, like, the where the traffic stop started, like, where the, like, we just traffic stop a lot for these small offenses. It was in neighborhoods that were struggling with crime. And, but it's like, it's supposed to be in a very specific situation, like, and it's expanded to way beyond how the, like, original studies and the original proponents of this approach were looking at. And it's that it's just grown way out of control. It's not serving anybody. It often escalates situations that don't need to be escalated, instead of sweeping up criminals or sweeping up people on the run or whatever they originally intended.
I think what you're referring to is, like, kind of the broken windows policing.
That, no, it wasn't sort of broken windows. Like, it was something different, but it's, like, yeah, related it's to, that. Yeah, definitely.
Right, which is this, which, you know, obviously was kind of a model for a period in the 90s. And then obviously it's turned into some very problematic things, stop and frisk. And,
you know, I'm reading Far From the Tree, and I'm reading the part on criminality right now and juvenile delinquency. And it's like, they're talking about all the, like, the ballooning of juvenile incarceration during the 90s. And it's just hard to beat, like, especially as a person who lived through it, just to not look back and think the 90s was just a really cruel time. I don't know what was going on, but we got so many things wrong in the 90s.
Yeah, I'd say. I mean, I think we get many things wrong in every decade. It's just that sometimes it takes a while for things to show for the negative side effects to rear their ugly heads. And I do think there's no doubt that some of the national policy, as well as regional local policies with policing, that sounded great on paper and maybe in the interim period had a downward effect on violent crime, ultimately have led to some pretty negative outcomes in the long term.
Well, speaking of negative outcomes in the long term, the other thing we're going to talk about is that the Biden administration's call for the withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan. This is also a good, we decided, intro into a conversation about your politics and how often we fight, because this was one of our first big fights. Because after September 11th, when we were in college, I was pretty opposed to troops in Afghanistan and Iraq, and we got in some big fights about that.
We had some disagreements. I don't recall. You have a better memory of us just disagreeing about Afghanistan. I think the history of the Afghanistan war is one that was largely wildly supported by the public because of the immediate aftermath of 9/11. The Iraq war was the one I recall us having more heated discussions over, because I guess I wanted to believe that Colin Powell wouldn't lie to the UN about the reasons for going to war, and you were much more circumspect about the reasons and rationale for the war.
Well, because remember, I was in senior seminar with Dr. Fryman from Transy, and we were literally, like, the whole focus of the class was U.S. involvement abroad, like the Vietnam War, the Korean War, like all these different. It was so brutal to be learning the history of how this fails every single time and how complicated it is, and how, like, we feel this very emotional rush to war, and how it, like, feeds certain things, and it never works out the way we thought it was. And, like, to feel all that and see all that and watch what was happening in the national landscape, like, it just, you know, I would love for this to be an opportunity for us to go on record with how right I was at the time. But it really was about the class I was in like learning that history and seeing it play out in front of you was just so frustrating. But yeah, we got into some pretty hardcore fights, as I remember.
Well, and I guess we should back up. My politics are not too different from Sarah's, I think. But in this case, I think, particularly with the Iraq War, I think there was just some disagreement about the necessity of it. And ultimately, Sarah was more than right. I think mm-hmm. it's what's shown in both of these wars is that attempting to nation build, attempting to democratize, or however you want to put it, countries in which we have very little understanding of the politics and which are not particularly welcoming to our brand of quote unquote democratization, mm-hmm. Which is usually perceived as invasion, so to speak, doesn't really work. And I think that's what Joe Biden sort of admitted yesterday, ultimately. Yeah. And he's been a critic. Biden's been a critic of the Afghanistan presence for a long time.
From the beginning when he was on the foreign relations.
Sure. But I mean, since when he was vice president, I think he pushed for troop drawdowns. And I think he's seen, as he said yesterday, four presidents have presided over the Afghanistan war. And he's not going to send it to a fifth. And his point was basically, this just hadn't worked. You know, we keep thinking that we can go in and we can clear the areas of the Taliban, we can grow, and then we can hold and build. And the hold and build part has been almost impossible.
Yeah, people don't really stay still.
Well, and I think,
was like, that's kind of an interesting way to think. Like, well, clear it out and no one will come in again. Well, why? Because we're just going to tell people to? Like,
sure. And I think that there is some fear and probably some reality in that the areas that we have helped to, you know, clear or build or whatever it is, many of them will probably end up back in the hands of the Taliban. And there's some downside to that.
Right. And let's not assume that this is all just on some road to peace. And we've all, as the American government, really reevaluated our complete approach to the world. Because part of this is they want to focus more on China and Russia, right? Like, it's not that we've decided we're going to deal with our enemies completely differently, although I don't expect any sort of occupation or violent action towards China or Russia. It's more like, well, we got to focus our energies on a different enemy right now. And I think, like, this is one of the few times we had a disagreement where I felt more liberal than you. I think the people might be surprised to hear that often it is the other way around, and that you are consistently liberal. And can I fairly call it less than nuanced, less than grace-filled?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could call it that. You could call it that. So I guess I should just talk about my background, because it's very helpful, I think, in understanding of the four Pantsuit Politics partners, I guess, meaning relationships, being Beth and Chad and Sarah and I. I'm the only one who really grew up in an urban setting, I would say.
Yes, that's true.
I grew up outside of Atlanta in a town called Decatur, Georgia. It's at a bit of an idyllic little town still, although it's changed quite a bit since I've lived there, and gentrified quite a bit since I've lived there. But went to elementary school, middle and high school, lived there basically my entire young life. And it's a very liberal town. And that environment certainly shaped me. I was born at the tail end of the Carter administration, and Jimmy Carter, the only president from Georgia, still has a bit of a following there. And my parents were both fairly liberal as best I could tell, although they weren't. I knew that they voted Democratic for the most part. My mother has over the years voted occasionally for a Republican presidential candidate or two. I sort of stopped asking after she voted for George W. Bush. But it's certainly as a child, I understood that we were Democrats. And I think really we were Democrats, or I was a Democrat in the sense that I was sort of for Democratic politicians. And I agreed with what Democratic politicians wanted to do because they were Democratic politicians. Mm. And I think as I've aged, I've realized that that's not, as we discussed with, certain policing and certainly with the welfare reform and some other things that were done in the Clinton administration.
Yeah, the cruelty of the 90s.
The cruelty of the 90s showed me that perhaps just being in favor of Democratic politicians isn't really my politics. So I do think as I've gotten older, despite what people used to tell me was I would get more conservative as I got older, I think I've gotten more liberal as I've gotten older. And I think that's driven, and this is going to sound kind of contradictory, but it's driven largely by the fact that I felt like the conservative party, Republican Party maybe, or just conservatives, just there was so much hypocrisy in the way that they kind of played the game. And so interestingly enough, you know, when I was,
we lived in D.C. for 5 years.
Well, we lived in D.C. for 5 years. But, you know, when I was a kid in the 90s, Newt Gingrich was the Republican, you know, standard bearer in a lot of ways. Well, he was a Georgia politician. So I was kind of right there in that, you know, the thick of the people who supported Newt Gingrich. And then, as you know, even then, I think I would say I felt like the two parties were mostly toward the center of the political spectrum, and that we could disagree with nuance. Everybody was on the same page. Everyone was acting in good faith. Well, Newt Gingrich, I think, started the road down to this sort of bad faith, what I would call bad faith politics. And I think even more interestingly, I went to college in Kentucky and now live in Kentucky, where Mitch McConnell, the current standard bearer for the Republican Party, who in my
sort view, of
is,
parts of
well,
it.
Fair enough. The current standard bearer for some wing of the Republican Party is, of course, the senator. And I'm forced to see his name on the ballot every 6 years. And I think his particular brand of politics has really turned me much more negatively toward the Republican Party, and maybe even pushed me more liberally, just in a response kind of stance
well,
to that.
Well, because I think what a lot of our disagreements are about is you project often, I think, that bad faith on like everyone who votes Republican. And I'm always the one being like, I don't think that's fair. Like, I see the bad faith. I recognize the bad faith. I am as furious as you are by the bad faith of people like Mitch McConnell and Newt Gingrich. And also, we cannot project that on everybody who votes Republican.
And that's fair in its own right, I guess. I mean, we have lots of friends who I'm sure vote Republican. I don't necessarily judge people or put people in a box. I'm not here to disown people because they vote Republican. But I find it very hard as a person who considers myself a thinking person to see how you can continue to support politicians who just have such bad faith policies. And I'll point to one in particular, which is...
But they don't think they're subverting the politicians. They're in a community. So they're just continuing to live in that community of people. Like, they see the people around them. They're not thinking about Mitch McConnell necessarily.
Fair enough. And I think that's probably fair. But at the same time, when you have somebody who... when you have a party and a politician in particular who takes this very allegedly principled stand against, even considering to confirming a Supreme Court nominee in the last year of a president's term, and then turns around and and ignores that allegedly principled stand, and even, in fact, makes light of it and jokes about it in a public forum in Paducah, in fact.
Yeah, that happened in Paducah. So true.
It's infuriating because I think
there was not a lot of grace-filled conversation in the Holland household between either of us at that point in time.
Well, and I also just think it tears at the this is going to sound so idealistic, but it sort of tears at democracy. It tears at people's trust that there's any real good faith among each other. And I think that's what you're seeing now becoming the policy of the Biden administration, which is you guys have never, particularly not since Obama, have never really played fair.
Yeah.
But you always wanted us to play fair, and you didn't want to.
Promise that you would agree, but you were never, ever going to agree.
And that's the same thing with this infrastructure conversation, which is, and I think that it may be bad for this infrastructure bill ultimately, because I think that there's probably some legitimate criticisms of some of the things that the Biden administration wants to do. And there may be some room for real compromise if there was a sense that compromise was actually going to get you a vote.
Right.
And then even more infuriating, right, is these guys don't even vote for bills, right? They didn't vote for this most recent stimulus, whatever you want to call it, economic impact bill.
Relief.
But now they're doing tours of their states calling it Christmas in July. Our congressman here in Paducah, Jamie Comer, is calling it Christmas in July and saying, well, all this money coming to, you know, McCracken County, which is the county we live in, and their surrounding counties, this is going to be great for your communities. Well,
he didn't vote for it.
But now he's
infuriating.
He can take some credit for it.
Well, so. And as you were talking, I was thinking like, and that's why there was polarization. I hate to use that word. I don't really, but like the tearing at that fabric, because I think I was making that argument, and I think a lot of people were making that argument. Well, that's not me. That's Mitch McConnell. But then Donald Trump pushed it so far, I think, that people could no longer reserve for some goodwill for Republican voters in the face of Republican leadership. You know what I mean? Like, I think there became this break where it was like, I cannot separate you. Donald Trump made it really, really difficult to separate people from their vote, right? And you couldn't say like, well, yeah, you're not paying attention to the inside baseball of what Mitch McConnell's doing, and you don't realize like what a hypocrite he is. And so I can reserve some goodwill for you when you can see what Donald Trump's saying all over Twitter every day. And how am I supposed to reserve any goodwill for you when you can see with your own eyes how he behaves and what he does and the policies that he supports? And I think that's where it became really, really hard, if it possible, to...
Yeah, I mean, I think I crossed the bridge before Donald Trump. I mean, I was not obviously thrilled with Donald Trump's presidency in any respect, but I think I had kind of crossed the bridge before the 2016 election these guys. And I hate to say it, like, they don't play fair, because politics isn't supposed to be fair, but they pretend to want to play by a set of ground rules that they just routinely ignore. And they
The voters. I mean, separating the leadership from the voters.
I guess. I mean, but I have a hard time. You're not wrong. I have a very hard time.
You do. You don't like to do that.
Because I guess maybe just because I feel like that people ought to be paying attention. Yeah. And I get that people don't have time, and I get that it's complicated, and I get all that on a cerebral level, but at an emotional level, it just feels like...
Anger is a secondary emotion, though, right. Nicholas. What's behind that anger?
Sadness, I'd say, probably. Right. Just like, you know, like a feeling of like, feel like we could be a better country if we could be, if we could all act out of some set of good faith principles that we're not always, you know, this whole thing that we're taught as kids, like, oh, compromise it's the root of our democracy. Well, is it? Yeah.
I mean, I think that's our book in the Extra Credit Book Club, Kill Switch. Adam Gentleson is arguing like, no, it's not. And it's like we overemphasize compromise
and I think
in America.
That it's been to the detriment of policies that I would typically support.
I think that's the brilliance of the Biden administration saying, oh, we're compromising. We're listening to voters. We're not listening to you guys anymore. That's the difference. Right. We're not listening to congressional leadership and assuming that they represent everybody. Because the truth is, because of gerrymandering and a lot of different reasons, they don't really represent everybody. They represent some extreme factions that get louder voices. Like, I don't really think, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene, I hate to even mention her name. Like, it's not like she represents the majority of Republican voters. Even Republican voters, I don't think that she does. Maybe I'm being
I think that's naive. A whole other story, though. I mean, I think
she's from Georgia, too. Good job, Georgia.
She is. Well, John Lewis is also from Georgia.
That's true.
Some things.
That's true. And you have two Democratic senators.
We do, which is just a real... shock to the system.
You were shocked. You were definitely
shocked. DeKalb County is where I grew up, and I kind of know the politics there a lot better than most of the rest of Georgia. Was immersed in it at some point. Yeah, it's in the main, I would say, I understand that not every Republican voter supports every Republican policy, but in my moments...
I mean, obviously, you live in Paducah, Kentucky, my moments just like rage through the streets every day.
My moments of lack of nuance come when the Republican leadership pulls stunts that just seem to be just sort of antithetical, probably.
Is dramatic. He doesn't even have to stunt. It's like every time Mitch McConnell speaks, I'm like, God.
That's what kind of gets my heart rate going.
And
my
you have
blood
high blood pressure, so you really need to not
do
that.
I do.
As your wife, I need to advise you against that.
Okay, got it.
Is there anything else you wanted to add?
About Afghanistan, about Republicans? No. Okay. Not particularly. I don't think this is going to go well if I get too much more wrong about it.
Do we have a moment of hope for this episode? We're both fully vaccinated. Let's let that be our moment of hope.
That's a good moment of hope. Yeah. Both fully vaccinated. 1.5 million Kentuckians are...
Beautiful.
Adult Kentuckians are vaccinated, which is almost... I mean, Kentucky's population is about 4 million. So we're getting close to half of at least one dose for adults in Kentucky, which has been awesome.
That's awesome.
Go Governor Beshear and all the people who have been helping to get those vaccines in arms. It's been great.
We love it. All right, next up, we're going to talk about national parks.
I recently reorganized my closet and realized that I never need to buy a white blouse or a blue dress again as long as I live. Guys, I have plenty. I did want to add some much neglected color, like pink and yellow, to my closet, and I knew just where to go. Quince always has timeless pieces and a true rainbow of options that can help you build a classic wardrobe no matter the season. It's getting warmer, so I got a soft pink chiffon pleated miniskirt that is so cute, and a really beautiful yellow cashmere tee. It's short-sleeved. It's perfect for the sort of bridge weather we're experiencing right now. And the best part is all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I absolutely love it. Get warm weather ready with Quince. Go to quince.com/pantsuit for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/pantsuit to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/pantsuit.
We're finally at my favorite time of year. Spring is here. Summer is just around the corner. We're getting our summer essentials ready. Our sunscreen, our emotional support water bottles, our steamy beach reads. But maybe you would prefer your steamy earbuds. This year, there is a new kind of essential right at your fingertips. Enemies to love. Chance encounters, a slow burn, friends that become more. Whatever your favorite romantic trope, Dipsy has a spicy audio story just for you. Dipsy is an app full of hundreds of short and spicy audio stories that bring scenarios to life with immersive soundscapes and realistic characters. You can discover stories about second chance romances and adventurous vacation flings. That's my favorite. Hot and heavy hookups. It can be as heavy or as light as you want it to be. This is what I love about Dipsy. It is a modern approach to romance. Through high quality, captivating audio fiction that you can listen to in the privacy of your own headphones. For listeners of the show, Dipsy is offering an extended 30-day free trial when you go to dipsystories.com/pantsuit. That's 30 days of full access for free when you go to dipseastories.com/pantsuit. That's dipsystories.com/pantsuit.
Traditionally, financial planning advice is either only for those who are already wealthy or salespeople calling themselves financial advisors who say they'll give you free financial advice but really just sell products to earn commissions. Fearless Finance takes a dramatic departure from either of those traditional models. Their entire business is built on making financial advice accessible and affordable because we know that financial literacy, stress reduction, and financial security are critical to overall well-being. I'm a little bit obsessed with Elizabeth, our Fearless Finance advisor. I've had an array of advisors in the past who answered questions like, should we be spending less on this, with evasive answers like, it depends on your priorities. Not Elizabeth. She answers with actually helpful guidelines. You're spending more than the average family of five, or I'd like to see this increase by 6%. Thank you. This is Fearless Finance's mission, to make advice affordable and accessible. You meet with your planner virtually and they charge you by the hour. You only pay for the time you use down to a quarter hour. Their planners meet with you where you are on your financial journey, no judgment. Visit fearlessfinance.com today. You can chat with a planner for free to make sure it's a good fit, and you'll get $50 off your first planning meeting when you use the code PANTSUIT. That's fearlessfinance.com and use code PANTSUIT for $50 off your first planning meeting.
When we decided to have you on the show, we talked about, you have a history of telecommunications as well, but then just did telecommunications. We really didn't want to give people 2 weeks of telecommunications because it is not that interesting. No offense.
Well, that's not fair. I think there's a lot to talk about with telecommunications. I was a telecommunications lawyer for about 4.5 years when we lived in D.C. I worked at a big law firm on K Street that did telecom policy and lobbying and worked on several, I guess you would call, high-profile mergers. And I was involved in wireless telecom as well as satellite telecommunications and wireline, which is, of course, the plain old telephone system. But I've been out of that world for a long time, and it moves fast. And so trying to get caught up even in kind of what's going on in telecom today is a big lift. But I think a lot of what's going on is that we're still acting under a law that's 25 years old in a world that's changed a lot as with regard to telecom and internet. Which I'm sure Pantsuit Politics will cover one day, but not today.
So instead, we decided to talk about something you feel very strongly about, and it happened to coincide with a piece in The Atlantic that we both found really interesting. And we're going to talk about national parks. So our national park system is 85 million acres, 423 national park sites. We are in the middle of trying to check off as many national parks as we can as a family, because I gave you a scratch-off national park poster for Christmas, which has just really lit a fire under us. We are ready to
scratch them off. It has. Not just us, but a lot of people have been, in the pandemic, have been rediscovering the national parks. And the national parks have been in the news in the last couple of years because, of course, one of Trump's premier I guess he would call it a premiere.
Would he? I think he doesn't even mention it that often. He doesn't.
He has a mixed record with the national parks. Of course, there's two national park sites, Barrieres and one that I can't bring to mind right now, that he actually shrunk during his time.
He
went from, I think he shrunk it by 85% in Barrieres. And so that was, he had a mixed record, certainly about national parks. But one of the things that he signed into law with a lot of bipartisan support was, of course, the Great American Outdoors Act, which set aside $9 billion for national parks projects that had been sort of put on the back burner. One of the things that I think we'll talk about a little bit is visitation in national parks has increased 50% since 1980, I think is the number, but the actual funding stayed relatively flat. And so there were lots and lots and lots of projects that were going, maintenance in particular, that was just going undone. And, you know, staffing, of course, was of course limited because they weren't able to increase staffing. And so that bill, that law now provided a lot of funding for the national parks and also provided a longer term source of funding for national, local and regional kind of parks through the kind of a trust fund that's funded by offshore drilling.
Well, so we just returned from spring break where we went to South Florida to see three national parks. We went to the Everglades, Biscayne Bay, and Dry Tortugas. And it was like, I thought it was such a good cross-section of just the, even in one state, the diversity of the national park system. Because, you know, we went to the Everglades, which is huge, thousands and thousands of acres of this river of grass. Then went to Biscayne Bay, which is thousands of acres underwater. Mm-hmm. And then we traveled 2.5 hours on a boat ride out to Dry Tortugas, which is small. I mean, I think Dry Tortugas also includes a lot of the water acreage.
Right, right. The actual national park area is the islands. Right.
And then there's like a big fort. Like it's sort of a national, it's like, you know, when people think of national parks, they don't think of a small island with a giant brick fort on it, but that's what it is.
Fort Jefferson is built on the Dry Tortugas, on the largest island that make up the Dry Tortugas. And it is interesting to think about, you know, the theory, I guess, behind national parks in some ways is to appreciate nature in its untampered with state.
Yeah.
And this is very much not that. And mm-hmm. a lot of the money that goes toward the Dry Tortugas and keeping it up is in keeping the fort, which is more of a historical site. You know, it's more of a, like a Fort Sumter type of thing, or even
the biggest brick building in both Americas.
Even
I learned.
Yeah. Even like Fort Zachary Taylor, which is
in Key West,
you know, it's a similar type of site, but it's not a national park. It's a state park, but there's a lot less focus, I think, now on the fort part. Whereas in Dry Tortugas, I'd say it's about 50-50 of people who go there to to see the fort and people who go there for the natural habitat.
The snorkeling is good because of the fort.
Because they like structures to build for coral
to grow on.
Sure.
I thought it was like a really good cross-section. But I mean, look, we're going to Hot Springs this weekend, and Hot Springs is the same thing. Like, it's a natural place, but it's also like a historical site because of the baths that were built up around the springs. So I think the national park system, like the diversity, not just in the landscape, but the way that they are handled. I mean, like the Smoky Mountains is one of the most visited national parks because it has a highway running through it.
Right, right. And there's no fees.
And then when you get out west, which I think people usually associate with the national parks, then you get into the Yosemite, the Yellowstone, Death Valley, all the national parks in Utah. And then you're getting into the vistas I think people more readily recognize. But there really is just so much out there. We also looked up all the states that didn't have national parks, which was kind of a surprising list. Like Louisiana, why don't you have a national park? That's surprising to me.
Right. There are sort of different designations. There are national parks per se, and then there's other national park sites. There's the national recreation areas. So, for example, Kentucky has a national park at Mammoth Cave, which is another fairly developed site, so to speak.
There were cave wars. Did y'all know this? There was violence surrounding the caves and who controlled them for a long time.
But then we also have Land Between the Lakes, which is a national site, but it's a national recreation area. Mm-hmm. And that designation is a little bit given to sites that are more about recreation versus conservation. So a lot of the stuff around the national parks has been, you know, improving maintenance, improving conservation. There's a lot of push to get more science back into the national parks versus just tourism.
Because that's hard. Like, if you're conserving things and you want to build appreciation, but bringing humans into that is a conservation challenge every time.
Right. And so that's, you know, you'll hear this said a lot, that the national parks are being loved to death, that the increase in tourism to the sites, and that naturally leads to people sort of using the permitted sites, overusing the permitted sites, but also going into the unpermitted sites and sort of, you know, bushwhacking, so to speak, if that's a term we can use. I think, you know, what the push has been, and it's always kind of been pushed back on, is to try to get some of these sites that are sort of seen as overused on a kind of a lottery system, on a kind of reservation system, where they're not just being just used and used and used and used and used, but it's not, they haven't kind of hit the right way to do that, that doesn't lead to, you know, pushback from, you know, regional, these particularly in the American West, so to speak, which is a problematic probably phrase in the first place. It's a huge tourist industry. You know, there's so many national parks in the West. You look at this scratch off calendar we have, and it's like
Utah.
If we lived in California or Utah, we'd have
The two states with the most, right?
I think that's right. I think we'd have quadruple the sites that we could visit in a day's drive. You know, so you know we are. I think at the same time that we are considering and pushing to see a lot of these sites, are having to consider the impact that, you know, we as humans are having on these sites. And how to dampen that impact. And that, I think, is kind of a natural lead into what this article that was written by David Truer at The Atlantic, which essentially, somewhat convincingly to me anyway, argues that the national park sites should be effectively turned over to the Native American tribes in the U.S. for there to administer. And, you know, the basis of his reasoning is, I don't think he puts it as reparations, but he spends a lot of time talking about the history of the American Indian and Native American in reservations and how they've shrunk and how they were forced off the lands through various means, wars, being forced to sign treaties that were not honored, being forced to turn over lands in exchange for health care or food just to survive harsh winters after they were forced off their original lands where they were typically able to survive these harsh winters. So it's a really, really good article for a history of that process, I guess, is the nicest way to put it.
Well, and I think the history part is a really important piece to start with, because this reminds me of an experience we had while we were on vacation. We went to Dry Tortugas. It is this massive brick fort, and it was built by enslaved people and indentured servants from Ireland and Scotland in really brutal, terrible conditions. And we talked about that, and both Griffin and Amos were like, well, I feel bad now. I feel guilty being here, because I know that people suffered to build it. And I think that's, you know, I think you have to acknowledge that piece of almost any national park that you visit, and that if you're enjoying this beautiful vista, I mean, he starts with this historical vignette from the Mariposa Battalion who came into the first white men to come into the Yosemite Valley. And this beautiful quote, which I would bet, I have not seen the Ken Burns National Parks documentary, but I bet you money it's in there. I can hear the narrator in his voice saying this quote, and it's beautiful. And it's about how seeing it and you're looking to God. And then the next quote is about this just horrendous quote about Native people and how they should all be killed, and the same guy, you know? And I think it's really hard to hold those things. And it's hard to talk with your kids about I brought you to this beautiful place and I want you to see it and connect with it and see how beautiful it is. And also, it's a place of great suffering, and the history that brought us here is complicated. And to ask an 11-year-old or a 9-year-old to hold that is hard, because it's hard for me to hold all of that. And I think, you know, I was listening to Tressie McMillan Cottom on Ezra Klein's podcast, and she was saying that the promise of multiculturalism is not that everyone gets as comfortable as the privileged people, right? It's not that everybody rises up to this place where we don't ever have to think about this stuff again. It's that the privileged people come into the place we're all living in, which is, it's uncomfortable. There are no easy answers. Conversations are hard. That's the reality, right? That privilege so often protects us from. And it's not that we're not going to get to a place where it's uncomfortable or uncomplicated. And I think the national parks, and it's definitely as illustrated by this article, are a really intense manifestation of that, because they are places that are so beautiful and so grand and can connect you to something so much bigger. And also, they are the sites of enormous pain. And I mean, really, the truth is, every spot on earth is a place of enormous pain in a way, right? Like, I think that That's just the reality of human existence. But it's hard to, like, I didn't really know what to say to Griffin and Amos except for, yeah, I know, but we can't, you know, in an effort to not feel that discomfort, we cannot ignore the painful reality of the history of this place. But I also don't think that the best way to honor that history is to, like, never see these places. And that's definitely not what David Truer is arguing. He's not arguing shut them off. He's just arguing them and trust them to people who have a different approach and understanding of the land. And I love the part where he says, like, you know, Native Americans, despite genocide, first of all, and then horrific attempts to assimilate them from, like, basically kidnapping their children and putting them in boarding schools and not letting them keep their language, like, they have maintained this approach to the land, and the rest of us have caught up. Like, their understanding of the land and how to interact with it is where our understanding has finally caught up to. I mean, I think that's the why we're loving the national parks to death, in a way, is because people, there's so many more people, so many of us, but that so many of us are coming to that understanding of the land as a way to connect and as a thing to behold and participate in. Although I unfortunately think there's a lot of consumerism still embedded in that, unfortunately.
Definitely. There's a lot of consumerism involved in some of these sites in particular. You know, it's an Instagram site to go and get your picture taken and do your picture, take your picture as if one more picture of Arches National Park, of the famous site of Arches, like your picture from your iPhone of Arches National Park is going to be
Listen, I took lots of pictures of dry tortugas and I posted them on Instagram. No judgment.
But not to be too critical of that, but I think there is a ton to be done. You know, even if you disagree with his ultimate conclusion, which is that they should be turned over to American Indian, or I'm not sure. I guess he uses
like a tribal coalition.
He uses Native American, so I'll use Native American, but to the tribes, if you disagree with that, even there's a ton more that can be done in terms of education. Mm-hmm. And I think that Sarah points out an interesting part of that, which is, of course, that there were enslaved persons who helped to build Fort Jefferson. Roughly 20%, I think, of the workforce was enslaved persons. That's sort of just a kind of a blip in the conversation.
They don't emphasize
them. You know, a lot of the emphasis is put on the white leaders who had so much wisdom as to put a naval base here, or to put a fortress here to protect our naval waters, instead of the peoples who built the ding dong thing.
Yeah.
But I think that's a lot can be done at a lot of the parks that were American Indian homelands to improve education about what happened. I think there is some effort. You know, there are some trails. There's a Trail of Tears monuments. There's one near us, actually, that kind of marks the Trail of Tears and provides education about that. So, I think
that's hard, too, because I think he makes a really good point in this article of, like, it can become where American Indians are, like, past, right? Like,
right.
Where that only orientation is through the history. And I think that one of the strongest arguments in the article is that, like, the tribes are still here and the people are still here. And there was a part where he talks about, like, the population is larger than American Muslims. And I'm not going to lie, I was surprised by that. If you'd asked me what has a larger population, American Indians or American Muslims, I would have said American Muslims. And so, like, just emphasizing, like, the administration of the parks, because it's not just, it wouldn't just be about emphasizing the history, but about emphasizing the presence and the, you know, important belonging within the nation right now, and the presence of those tribal nations within our country. And I think that's really important too. I think the American Indian Museum in Washington, D.C. does a really good job of that, of, like, balancing the history with the presence of tribal people now, today, living, breathing, contributing to our country. And I think that's really important too.
Definitely. Like I said, if you agree or disagree with the ultimate outcome of the article, it's definitely worth your time, 100% worth your time. And I think he makes some very compelling arguments that this would be a kind of a opportunity to value that history and to turn these back over to the peoples who originally lived on them.
Right. And I just think it's a step towards reconciliation. And I think it is, if we value the national parks, then in what bigger way could we emphasize the ways in which we value land and the power that we think those lands have. And that, you know, even he talks a lot about Teddy Roosevelt, lots. You can't talk about the national parks without talking about Teddy Roosevelt. And, you know, the conflict between this man who, you know, believed in the power of nature and also was like believed in the power of colonialism and violence. Right. But I think, like, how could we, you know, reconcile those things? What a better way to reconcile than we say, not only do we value these lands and we believe in the power of them, we believe in the power of these lands so much that we believe that they could be an instrumental part in real reconciliation, which our country is so desperate for. Like, they could hold such a special place, like not just the history of violence and genocide and death, but could hold this place in the history of reconciliation where we say the lands now belong back to the tribal people. They administer them. There is like trust given back. Lands given back. I think that could be so healing and like really beautiful.
Right. And his argument, of course, is not that these, like Sarah mentioned, is not that these would be closed.
No.
But in fact, they would remain open to, I think he even says to the Instagram influencer, to whoever, but it would simply be administered by the American Indians and the tribes, who have a history of administering lands and having their own governments, you know, governments which have been recently recognized by re-recognized by the Supreme Court. History of rights. And so the idea is not that these would be closed off to other peoples, simply that the administration of them would be turned over. And of course, that would still require funding because these things aren't, they don't pay for themselves. Despite being loved to death, they don't yet pay for themselves and probably never will. So they will require funding, and they will probably require, you know, future conservation efforts and efforts to limit the number of people who are loving them to death, so to speak. So it's really, again, worth your time to consider and read. And I think it's...
And go visit your local national park.
Yeah.
Unless you're one of those sad states who doesn't have one and you have to go somewhere else.
Almost nobody is outside of a day's drive, that, you know, at least in the continental United States. There's a national park within your reach.
Yeah.
For sure.
Listen, y'all, let's be serious. I'm 42 years old. Of course, I take my skincare routine seriously. There are a lot of daily skincare products on the market claiming to help reduce fine lines and wrinkles, but how do you know your products are actually working? Well, Ritual is here for you. They have Hyacera, their once daily skin supplement, clinically proven to reduce wrinkles and fine lines and increase skin smoothness in 90 days. They conducted a clinical study and it led to a 3.6 times reduction in crow's feet within 90 days as compared to a placebo, and a 2.9 times increase in skin smoothness within 90 days as compared to a placebo. I love taking my Hyacera every day as part of my skincare routine instead of just slathering more products on my face. It feels like I'm doing something from the inside out. And their one daily capsule is essenced with soothing vanilla, so it's a very pleasant experience. Start Hyacera to help minimize wrinkles without compromising on clean science. Hyacera from Ritual is a clinically proven skin supplement you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/pantsuit. Start Ritual or add Hyacera to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/pantsuit for 25% off.
Spring is so tricky because I feel the sun shining, the earth is waking up, and I want fresh, vegetable-forward meals. And I'm running in 75 directions and don't have a lot of kitchen and prep time. Fortunately, Factor is here for me and for you with fresh, never-frozen meals that are chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in 2 minutes. They have a ton of options for us, including keto, protein plus, vegan, veggie, calorie smart, and so many add-ons. If you need help with breakfast or snacks or on-the-go lunches or beverages, Factor is here for you. Every meal I've had from Factor is so well composed, it's so flavorful, the sauces are delicious, and Factor is celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look for Earth Month Eats badges on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. Head to factormeals.com/pantsuit50 and use code pantsuit50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code PANTSUIT50 at factormeals.com/PANTSUIT50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Do you want a bra that's sexy or a bra that's comfortable? Thanks to Third Love, you can have both. Third Love was started to take all the frustration, ick, and ugh out of bra shopping. That's why they made solutions for every bra problem, aka problems. Their bras make it easy to bring back perkiness you haven't seen since high school, get smoothing you know where, and have straps that actually stay put. Designed at their headquarters in San Francisco and made from premium materials, they put every style through hours of wear testing on real women, including themselves, before it's given the stamp of Boop approval. Comfort and support are guaranteed. Plus, whether you're a AA cup or an H cup, their virtual fitting room will help you find your perfect fit fast. They even invented half cups, no more feeling stuck between two cup sizes that don't fit. It's time to get your problem solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get 15% off your order with code PODCAST15.
Okay, Nicholas, what's on your mind outside politics?
So we spent about a day and a half in the car driving to and from Key West, Florida in the last week. And we decided that there would be no better entertainment than to listen to Jimmy Buffett songs.
One and only.
The entire way there. We heard a lot of It's 5 o'clock Somewhere.
Yeah. Which is not a Jimmy Buffett song.
Well, no, right. It's an Alan Jackson song. It was written by somebody else. But he's in it, and it's kind of become a signature. Interestingly enough, they sell a lot of...
Our favorite Jimmy Buffett song is Boat Drinks.
It is. Boat Drinks is a...
Underappreciated.
It's a family favorite. We started going to Fripp Island, and we would play Boat Drinks. Or I would play Boat Drinks for you originally.
Yeah.
And you thought it was sort of obnoxious.
But now it's grown on me.
You've come around to it.
Come around.
But really, I think what we thought about and kind of what, as I was driving and thinking about, was just what a... kind of a salesman and a BS artist.
Well, what I said
Jimmy Buffett truly is. Now, mind you.
What I said halfway through there is I said, he is a siren. He is like the truest siren song in the like mythical sense of the word. Like he sings these songs. You start thinking, yeah, like I'm the palest human on planet Earth. Like I can't live Jimmy Buffett's life. But I'm like, yeah, I should do this. I should like definitely do my podcast from Key West. This is the life I want to live. Like. Right. It sounds amazing. I want to drink boat drinks and live in Margaritaville. And yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess I would say two things about that. One is that I don't think Margaritaville is a particularly hopeful song. he's wasting away again there.
But even that, he just sounds so fun.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like the life you want to live. And to say nothing of Jimmy Buffett has lived much more of a life than just as a musician, although he's become fabulously wealthy.
Well, yeah, we looked it up. He's worth $550 million. He's like one of the wealthiest celebrities out there.
But now you hear him sing these songs about, you know, particularly I think we were talking about 5 o'clock Somewhere, which is not his song, but it talks about, you know, the boss is on my rear and what a drag it is. And I'm just going to go have
but
a long
lunch. But he has other songs that
mention
and, that.
And
yeah.
Drink, you know, day drink. And
which neither of us do, which
right,
is also another
right,
funny
which
part of
this. He probably, and he, but he doesn't have a boss that's on his behind. He, you know, he, like I said,
well, I said that. I said, he's a siren. Let's give it up and live this life. And he was like, you were like, he doesn't live that life, Sarah. He has like Broadway musicals and restaurants.
Right, he tours all the time.
He tours. He has we did look it up though. He does live on water and he does take part of the year to be on his boat.
That's true. That's true. I mean,
I'm not trying to insult
he's a
Jimmy
real
Buck.
Sailor. I mean, he really did.
He is. And he's an excellent songwriter.
He is.
No doubt.
No takeaway from him. But he also, you couldn't just give it all up and go with living Key West. Particularly, you couldn't give
it's
it up and go live
there.
In Key West.
We looked it up on Zillow,
it ain't
man.
Cheap to live there for one thing.
That's my favorite hobby when we travel is to open up the Zillow.
I think my favorite thing about Key West is that you kind of thought it would be like six thatched roof huts on a beach. And it's obviously not that. It's
it
a very developed.
It was going to be so much
like primitive.
Smaller. Not primitive, but I thought it would be like a couple city blocks. It is not.
No, it's not.
It is like 29,000 people.
Right. It's not a huge place.
It has a
but
Publix.
It's bigger than, yeah.
That's not what I expected.
It has a Kmart too.
It does,
still has
which is
a Kmart,
weird.
Which was one of the more depressing experiences I had while on the island because this Kmart... I mean, it looked like somebody had bought a Kmart and just set up like a kind of like a flea market in it. It was just, I mean, not that bad, but it was not well stocked.
I mean, I did love, I don't want to, let me be clear. I loved Key West.
Oh, no, I'm not dragging Key West, but the Kmart in Key West was sad.
Yeah.
I think that's just the state of Kmart right now. And there being no Walmart on Key West, I think it stays open because you need a general store, so to speak.
Well, I mean, and the thing about Jimmy Buffett, too, is not just that his songs are like convincing, but they're also earworms to the like 10th degree. Mm-hmm. They are stuck in your head. We were days back home still singing Jimmy Buffett.
Well, we were also singing Kokomo a lot.
Yes, because we did a lip sync video to Kokomo, which I'll put the link to in the show notes. I'm very proud. So, because Dax Shepard and Kristen Bell a few years ago went to Africa and they filmed a lip sync video to Toto's Africa, which I loved. And the second I saw it, I was like, oh, we're going to do that. And so we did Kokomo And our 11-year-old was less than thrilled.
Yeah. He's turning very much into a tween. And he decided that we were trying to embarrass him, forcing him to do things. It was funny. He would come around and
every once in a while.
These flashes, he would say, oh, I'll do that. And so he's in the video and he's even smiling. But then, you know.
You're the real star, though. You're the real star of the video. Right. You leaned all the way in, which you would not have done 15 years ago.
No, I would have been Griffin 15 years ago.
Yes.
I would have been.
Even though you were not 11 15 years ago.
An overgrown man child complaining about his wife making him do
this. This is a good intro to how we should close out about how awesome I am. Because, like, look how much. Oh. It's my influence. Yeah.
You did turn it around and make it about that, didn't you?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Because your new embrace of enthusiasm is from me. Yes.
Well, I'm not going to say that it's not. Well, do you think my face suggests that I'm skeptical of this?
No.
I mean, I think that's right. I mean, I don't know about new embrace of enthusiasm, but just like, I think some of it's just recognition that I can fight this all I want. But ultimately, it's going to probably happen.
So just
I tell our kids, we can smile for the camera now. Or we can smile the camera in 15 minutes.
Because
we got to get the picture. So just smile for the camera.
Are you insinuating that I'm some sort of bulldozer?
No, not a bulldozer. But you get your mind set on something. And it's not an unreasonable request, really. I mean, it was fun. And I think the end product is a lot of fun.
It's okay.
And I don't regret it. But I mean, you have to kind of realize like, okay, she wants to do this. She's really got her mind set on it. She's really committed a lot of mental energy to it. She's not going to let this go. Just go with the flow and try to get over. Because all it really is about embarrassment, right? And feeling like you're being silly. And at the end of the day, like,
who cares,
right?
Well, I will say that, you know, look, you've been a bulldozer from kind of, I'm glad I gave up on you being like, no, really, you should start a podcast. No, for real, you should try to start a podcast. No, really, like, podcast is the future. You need to start a podcast.
Yeah. I mean, that's like my one great contribution to society.
It is.
It'll go down in history. It'll be my Wikipedia page. My whole Wikipedia page will be one time mentioned to his wife that she should start a podcast. And you know, born, you know, XYZ, died, whenever.
I love you, Nicholas Allen. You're the best decision I've ever made.
Well, ditto.
Thanks for joining us, everybody, for this special episode of Pantsuit Politics. Beth and I will be back together on Tuesday. I'm counting the seconds. I miss her so much. 2 weeks is a long time not to be like, obviously we've talked, but I miss the podcast. So we'll be back together on Tuesday. And until then, keep it nuanced, y'all.
Pantsuit Politics is produced by Studio D Podcast Production. Elise Knapp is our managing director.
Megan Hart is our community engagement manager. Dante Lima is the composer and performer of our theme music.
Our show is listener supported. Special thanks to our executive producers.
Sherry Blem.
Martha Brunitsky.
Linda Daniel.
Allie Edwards.
Janice Elliott.
Sarah Greenup.
Julie Haller.
Helen Handley.
Tiffany Hassler.
Barry Kaufman.
Molly Kors.
The Creeps.
Lori Ladau.
Lily McClure.
David McWilliams.
Jared Minson.
Emily Neasley.
Danny Osmond.
The Petsons.
Tawny Peterson.
Tracy Putoff.
Sarah Ralph.
Jeremy Sequoia.
Karen True.
Amy Whited.
Joshua Allen. Morgan McHugh. Nicole Berkless. Paula Bremer. And Tim Miller.
To support Pantsuit Politics and receive lots of bonus features, visit patreon.com/pantsuitpolitics.
You can also connect with us on our website, pantsuitpoliticsshow.com. Sign up for our weekly newsletter and follow us on Instagram at Pantsuit Politics.